Welcome back. Today's guest is Edward Slingerland, a professor of philosophy at the University of British Columbia. Edward Slingerland is the author of the books Try Not to Try and Effortless Action, which are both about a topic closely related to, if not identical to, the flow state. He also wrote a more recent book called Drunk, How We Sipped, Danced, and Stumbled Our Way to Civilization. Edward Slingerland, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
So I guess we should open by asking, why do so many humans like to get intoxicated?
Well, it makes us feel good. That's one reason. Until recently, that's pretty much where people stopped in terms of explaining it. So the standard story about why we have a taste for alcohol scientifically is that it's just an evolutionary hijack. That's the standard story, is ethanol is just hijacking reward centers in our brain. So it makes us feel good, but it shouldn't. It's just we figured this thing out and we're taking advantage of it. And what I'm trying to argue in Drunk, so what the dominant theory has been, that sometimes called the evolutionary hijack theory. Yep. There's also various mismatch theories where maybe a taste for alcohol was adaptive in the past, but it's not anymore. So dirty water hypothesis, ideas about micronutrients. But I argue in Drunk that none of these can be right, because alcohol, two things. Our taste for alcohol is very costly. It's very physiologically and socially costly in various ways. And it's also ancient. We've had this taste for probably at least 20,000 years. So quite a long time, enough time for genetic evolution to take care of it if it wanted to. So unlike other evolutionary mistakes, our taste for alcohol is costly and ancient. And so therefore, the fact that it's been preserved in our gene pool and in our cultural repertoire has to mean that there are countervailing benefits. And so a big part of the book is trying to walk through what some of those benefits might be.
Yep. So there's one theory that agriculture was actually invented to support mankind's drinking habits, as opposed to a desire to eat bread. Is that theory plausible?
I argue that it is. So again, in the same way we've been told our taste for alcohol is an evolutionary mistake, the standard story is the discovery of alcohol was a mistake. So we had agriculture first, and then at some point, you know, we left our bread making stuff out too long and it started to ferment, and we tried it and made us feel good and we had beer. But it's looking like, when you look at the archaeological evidence, it looks like it's probably the other way around. So hunter-gatherers in the Fertile Crescent, hunter-gatherers were gathering together and having these big religious festivals and constructing really impressive monumental architecture and feasting and drinking something. Yeah. We have these big vats that they were drinking out of, and it's almost certainly beer and probably hallucinogen-laced beer. So the so-called beer before bread hypothesis is that it's the desire to produce more and better intoxicants that led humans to settle down and create civilization. So it's a very direct sense, literal sense, in which intoxication gave rise to civilization.
That's wild. So the dirty water hypothesis sounds like you don't believe it. What is it about the dirty water hypothesis that doesn't hold up?
So the dirty water hypothesis is the claim that in our evolutionary past, it was challenging to get clean water. So before people understood public sanitation, a lot of the water surrounding us was probably contaminated. And it is true that if you take contaminated water and you ferment it, it becomes safe to drink. So the theory is, you know, before we had water filtration and other things like that, drinking beer was a way to get hydrated safely. There are a lot of problems with this theory. So the other way you can make water clean is just to boil it. And people have been boiling water for a really long time. It's much less time consuming than making beer. Plus beer, boiled water is a lot better for you physiologically than beer is when you look at the physiological impact. So it doesn't make sense in that regard. It's also the case that if you look at cultures that drink beer, they're also drinking untreated water. they're mixing untreated water into their beer, which completely defeats the purpose of fermenting it. And you have cultures like China. So I talk about the fact that China's been drinking only boiled water or tea for a very long time. So they have these kind of theories that are based on Chinese medicine about not wanting to harm your stomach qi. But I mean, I experienced this when I lived in Taiwan, that it's considered really bad for your health to drink they call it kai shui, open water is when you boil it. You should open the water first before you drink it. So they have strong cultural taboos against drinking non-boiled water, and yet they still drink a lot of alcohol. So, yeah. You know, this, if that the dirty water was the only function, then I don't think we would have needed to invent alcohol.
True. For the entertainment of my fellow Australians, I'm going to read a paragraph from your book about our country's history with alcohol. You write, "In early colonial Australia, power was so thoroughly dependent on the control and distribution of rum that the first building in New South Wales was a secure booze bunker, guarding the precious imported liquid that also served as the New South Wales primary currency," end quote. Was Australia unusual as a culture in its obsession with alcohol?
You guys are probably outliers. I don't know. Actually, I'm not sure where Australia is on global consumption of alcohol, but it's probably quite high. You guys are also like Canada, United States, other British colonies, former British colonies. We all have this northern, so-called northern drinking culture. So anthropologists talk about northern versus southern drinking cultures, referring to northern and southern Europe. So southern drinking cultures are like Italy, Spain, Portugal, where they drink primarily beer and wine. It's always drunk with a meal, around a meal table. It's done communally with everyone, old people, kids, everyone's around the table. Kids are introduced to alcohol at an early age in a watered down form. So kids, you know, get a little, in Italy, they get a little wine mixed into their water at the dinner table. Being visibly drunk is considered shameful for an adult, so you would never drink so much that you become visibly drunk. So that's a southern culture. Northern cultures drink a lot of distilled liquors, which are a lot stronger than beers and wines. They often just drink. There's no food. They're just getting together to drink. It's often a bunch of dudes getting together on their own, so a bunch of men without anyone else drinking together. Yeah. Getting visibly drunk is considered what you're supposed to do. This is considered the goal, right? There's something kind of not cool about not getting really, really drunk. And so, you know, Australia, and I've spent a little bit of time in New Zealand and Australia, and I don't think I've ever seen that degree of public drunkenness, like on the weekends. Really? It's really, okay. Yeah, it's the most, maybe it was just I got a bad weekend or something in Sydney, but it was really quite extreme. So I think, you know, Australia is very much a northern drinking culture, and there's good evidence that that's more dangerous. Alcoholism rates tend to be higher in northern drinking culture societies, and much lower. So like a culture like Italy, per capita, they actually drink a lot of alcohol, but they have quite low rates of alcoholism. And it probably has something to do with this kind of healthier culture around drinking.
Yeah. And you were saying in your book too that alcohol used to have a very low percentage usually of, alcoholic beverages used to have a very low percentage of alcohol in them before the science was perfected.
Yeah. So natural fermentation has limits. So you've got yeast converting starches and sugars into alcohol, and they're doing it to kill off bacteria because they're more resistant to alcohol than the bacteria are. So it's kind of biological warfare, but they're not infinitely resistant to alcohol. At a certain point, the alcohol poisons them and they shut down. And so that creates this natural limit to how strong a beverage can get. And so historically, beers came in at like 2-3% ABV, and fruit wines a little bit stronger, maybe 5-7%. So one thing humans have been doing is pushing yeast to get tougher and tougher. And so we've been able to make stronger beers and wines because we've been breeding these kind of super tolerant yeast. And yeah. So, you know, in Australia, you guys could get these like 16.5%, these Shiraz yeah. that are just incredibly powerful. But still, you can only get up to about 16.5, 17% maybe.
Yeah.
But at a certain point, we figured out this trick, which was distillation. So when you can distill liquor, you basically have found a sneaky way around the limits of natural fermentation because you just keep pulling the alcohol off and concentrating it. And then you can get up, you know, into the 90s ABV, so incredibly strong substances. So one thing I point out in the book is that you know, all the benefits I talk about with alcohol and our whole history with alcohol has been with these relatively low ABV substances, which are a lot safer to consume.
Yeah.
And then relatively recently, like 1600s in Europe, is when we start to get distilled liquors in any kind of large scale. And distilled liquors are just so much more powerful than beers and wines that I think they really should be considered a different drug, yeah. even though they're still just ethanol. So we're just not genetically or culturally adapted to be drinking spirits.
True. And as William Booth from the Salvation Army had written, the drink difficulty lies at the root of everything. 9/10 of our poverty, squalor, vice, and crime springs from this poisonous taproot. Many of our social evils, which overshadow the land like so many upas trees, would dwindle away and die if they were not constantly watered with strong drink. I noticed when reading your book that if you looked into any one culture, even in ancient times, you could find evidence of a pro-alcohol culture as well as a very anti-alcohol culture, all in the one culture. In your research, where is the line between positive alcohol use and negative alcohol use?
First of all, Booth is worried about distilled liquors primarily, right?
Yeah,
you get these new,
like it,
really
yeah.
powerful forms of alcohol that are really hard for people to drink safely. They just, if you have access to gin or rum or vodka, you can blow right past. So I argue in the book, most of the benefits that we get from alcohol kick in at about 0.08 BAC. So that's like, you know, a beer or two.
Right about
when you should not operate a motor vehicle. That's when you start to get the creativity enhancements and other benefits. If you're drinking a 2-3% beer, you could drink that all day long and never get beyond 0.08. If you're doing shots of tequila, you can blow right past 0.08 into really dangerous territory very quickly.
Yeah.
So you know, one way to kind of tip over into way more of the dangers and costs than benefits is to consume distilled liquors. They're just much more addictive, much more dangerous. The other thing I point out in the book is that historically, drinking has always been very regulated ritually, even formally, but also informally. So I talk about the ancient Greek symposium, these wine parties where the symposiarch, the host of the wine party, was in charge of deciding how much water to mix in with the wine and when to pass the wine around. So he was basically controlling everybody's consumption of alcohol.
Yeah.
And you see this in Chinese banquets as well, where you're not allowed to drink until someone makes a toast. You can't just drink as much as you want. So we have these kind of formal ritual ways of regulating drinking when we're together socially. Even in modern, very informal contexts, if you think about going to the pub with your friends, you tend to order drinks in rounds, right? People buy rounds. And so if you're drinking too fast, you can't just get another beer right away. You gotta wait until we finish and we order another round.
Yeah.
So that's regulating your drinking. You know, the bartender or the cocktail server could not make eye contact with you when they're going by and you're trying to order another drink if they think you've had too much.
Yeah.
You're even around like the dinner table, you can have, you know, your mother-in-law may give you a little bit of a stink eye if you're reaching for the wine bottle too quickly. There are all these ways often that we don't notice that we regulate each other's drinking when we're drinking socially. And all that, again, just like the limits on natural fermentation, all those safety features get stripped away when we have private access to alcohol, when we have, you know, a liquor cabinet at home that we can just serve ourselves from anytime we want, when we can just grab a bottle of cold Chardonnay from the fridge and refill our glass and there's no one there to stop us opening a second bottle, right? So drinking alone is a relatively new phenomenon. Having private access to alcohol is historically pretty unprecedented, and that makes alcohol much more dangerous today. And I think we've seen this during the pandemic, right? So during lockdown, problem drinking went way up. People's drinking habits became really unhealthy, and I think it's because we were removing a lot of the safety features.
Yeah. As we transition to your other book, Try and Not to Try, I think one quote from your book, Drunk, ties the two together nicely. You write, habitual drug use can create a situation where homeostasis, the ability to maintain physiological stability of mood or affect, becomes reset at a pathological or harmful point. This is reminiscent of my own writing on yoga and the flow state, as I often mention homeostasis and its relationship with perception. Now I'll tie that with another quote from your book, Try Not to Try. The conscious mind, ungrounded by the wisdom of the body, is remarkably incapable of taking care of business. So an interesting question that comes to mind is, does effortless action produced by a state of intoxication carry with it the same range of benefits as effortless action that comes about through an art form or some other sober form of forgetting the self?
Yeah, it's a good question. We certainly value one of them more than the other. So in religious studies, there's long been a tradition of feeling like mystical states attained through meditation or self-flagellation or sleep deprivation are somehow more real than mystical states attained through alcohol or psychedelics. In the book, I argue this is partly unjustified because they're both chemicals. So, you know, you can change your brain a lot of different ways. One way is to ingest a chemical substance. The other is to engage in extreme exercise or sit in an uncomfortable position for a very long time. So there's a kind of implicit mind-body dualism that results in, I think, some unnecessary value judgments. But it is possibly the case that states attained through non-chemical means are more sustainable in the sense that they're endogenous. You know, you've produced them yourself, so you're not dependent on an external substance, and they're not physiologically harmful, right? Meditating isn't going to hurt your liver, and it's very unlikely you're going to become. I don't know of any meditation equivalence to alcoholism, right? You're not going to ruin your life or ruin your family by meditating too much. Probably not. So in that regard, those non-external chemical substance means, are more sustainable and probably safer than using chemical intoxicants.
Yeah. Another quote from your book, Try Not to Try. A substantial literature on verbal overshadowing suggests that consciously reflecting on our perceptions or evaluations of taste and then being forced to put them into words actually impairs our judgment, end quote. I wonder what this says about our formal education in the arts. So few of the best musicians of the past century are university educated in music, and university arts courses encourage just the sort of appraisal that you warn against. Is it wise for a young artist to study the craft through university?
Well, it's important to realize that verbal overshadowing effect is only for non-experts. So for instance, with wine appreciation, let's say, if you don't know wine, you don't have a lot of sensory experience with wine, and you're not well-trained in using words to describe your taste experience with wine, you're going to experience negative verbal overshadowing. So it's going to impair your judgment. You don't see this with experts, though. Experts with a lot of domain experience can use language to describe their experience in a way that doesn't negatively impact their experience.
That's interesting.
So is real, the verbal overshadowing really happens in cases where you don't have sensory expertise in that domain. That said, you know, it takes a really, really long time to get to the point where words are helpful for you. And certainly in the earlier stages, words are going to interfere with you. And if it comes to performance, words, especially in the moment, words are very harmful, even for experts. So there is a, it's not verbal overshadowing, it's the activation of executive control that's harmful for experts. And so I talk and try not to try about the fact that so for beginners, if I tell you, if you're a beginning baseball player and I give you conscious instructions about how to swing the bat, that'll help you, you'll do better. But if you're a professional baseball player and I ask you to think, pay attention to how you're swinging the bat, you're going to hit worse than if you just hit the ball. So there's, it's not verbal overshadowing. It's having to do with the negative effects of executive function when you have a highly developed skill. So certainly if you're some kind of performer, musical performer, you need to not be engaging too much conscious attention or verbal description or, you know, attention when you're doing your thing. You need to let your trained hot cognition take over.
Having studied the art of effortless action so deeply, do you find you can easily get into a state of flow, or is an intellectual understanding not of help?
I think it helps. It doesn't guarantee that you can get into flow, because the what I call the paradox of Wu Wei, this paradox of how you can try not to try, is a real paradox. You can't just power your way through it or philosophize your way through it. Yeah. But being aware of the tension is helpful, and having at your disposal various strategies for kind of getting around it indirectly can be helpful. So I've noticed this. I think this affects my, I play tennis, kind of casual, recreational level. Yeah. But I think my secret weapon, and I'm not particularly great, I started as an adult, so, you know, I don't have the kind of natural ability that someone who started as a kid has. But my kind of secret weapon is that I don't get too worked up about it. You know, and I play against guys who are much better than me technically. But if they start to miss their serve or they hit a bad shot, they start to then think about it, and I can see them getting inside their own heads and getting more and more agitated. And sometimes I beat much better players because I don't care. Like, I just don't get hung up on winning or not winning. And that's partly, I think, the result of knowing about this tension and knowing how counterproductive thinking too much can be with physical skills.
That's interesting too. And now for a wild card question. What was the best career decision you ever made?
Yeah, that's a good question. Probably after my dissertation. So I wrote this dissertation on Wu Wei, on effortless action, but it was from a very traditional intellectual history standpoint, so just, you know, telling the story of these different thinkers, and I was just supposed to turn that had been accepted at Oxford University Press, and they were going to publish it. I just had to clean it up and fix some footnotes, but I discovered metaphor theory. So at my first job, a grad student in one of my seminars gave me this book that had just come out, Philosophy in the Flesh, Lakoff and Johnson.
Part of that. Yep.
So this is 1999. And it just blew my mind. It was exactly the theoretical apparatus I'd been looking for my whole graduate student career. And it suggested these new methods for analyzing texts. And so instead of turning in my dissertation, I went back to the primary text again, and I completely rewrote the manuscript and turned in a completely different book that bore very little resemblance to my dissertation. And it was, that was a very risky thing to do because it was completely new methodology, and no one had actually read it. You know, at least my dissertation had been vetted by my advisor and some other people, and this was completely unvetted. Because Oxford, you know, I said you should send this out to peer review again, and they were like, "Nah, we're sure it's fine." And I was like, "You really should do that," but they didn't. And so, like, no one had read this thing that I'd produced in this kind of feverish 2 years of writing. But it won a major book award in my field, and I think ended up having a really big impact, and sent me on this new direction where I've been incorporating psychology, cognitive science, evolutionary theory into my work. In a way that I think has been really productive, and helped me think about things I'm interested in philosophically in a much more interesting way than if I had just stuck with the stuff I had learned in grad school.
Yeah, that's awesome. George Lakoff's work has been very influential on me as well. Mm-hmm. Interestingly, I had Ian McGilchrist on the podcast once.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And he's been influenced by George Lakoff as well.
Yeah.
Where can listeners find you and your new book in paperback, and will you be releasing more in the future?
So my website's just my name, edwardslingerland.com, so pretty easy to find. And that's got all information about Drunk and all of my other trade book, Try Not to Try, and my academic books. It's also, I have lots of interviews and things too. Paperback edition of Drunk's coming out soon. I mean, I think it's on the way to me, but I think it's being released into the public at the end of the month. And yeah, in terms of next projects, the next trade book is going to be about hedonism. And I haven't entirely decided what the angle. There's a couple different books I could write about hedonism, and I'm not sure which one I want to write yet. But that's the next trade book. So that should be a lot of fun.
That sounds good. It's evolving in a pattern there.
Yeah.
From drunk to hedonism.
Yeah.
Okay. Edward Slingerland, thank you for coming on the podcast.
Thanks for having me.